I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Gubernatorial candidates Rick Scott and Charlie Crist are neck and neck in the polls, and the race is too close to call. In the final weeks of the campaign, the candidates are entering into a series of debates. The first one was last Friday. To recap last week's Telemundo debate and to preview this week's Florida Press Association debate, I'll speak with University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett. First, though, we'll talk about another debate that's raging in Florida, whether to legalize medical marijuana. That's something voters will be deciding this November. To talk more about the challenges of medical marijuana should Amendment 2 pass, I'll speak with industry consultant Adam Bierman. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by Adam Bierman. Adam Bierman is with MedMen. Thanks for coming in, Adam.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Amendment 2, specifically, it's up for a vote this November, but it's fairly broad. What's your understanding, Adam, of what the amendment encompasses and what the implications are if it passes?
Well, it's interesting because it is so broad and it is so vague. You guys have marijuana on your books as it stands right now, although it's being challenged in court as we sit here and have this conversation. But at the end of all the court challenges, there will be legal medical marijuana in the state of Florida. Amendment 2 broadens that legalization of medical marijuana, and it doesn't do much more except to turn it over to the Department of Health for them to figure out how they're going to actually implement your marijuana program.
Is there time between now and November for the Department of Health to do that?
No, that won't happen until after November. So as it stands right now, you've got Charlotte's Web bill, which I'm sure everybody's familiar with or at least heard about. Very controversial bill. Like I said, it's tied up in courts, and it will be maybe for the next month or two. But as soon as that gets worked out, there is medical marijuana. As soon as amendment passes, if and when Amendment 2 passes, it will broaden what the Charlotte's Web bill has already done, but it really just turns over the power to Department of Health, and the Department of Health at this point isn't working on that because it hasn't passed yet. So I think they start fresh as of November if and when it passes on how to implement that.
And the Charlotte's Web bill, if we're talking about that, there's, I think, five licenses which will be up for grabs for people to for growers. It's not very many. There's some debate over whether that's enough. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I always think that it's better to have as close to a free market model as possible, just because I think that provides the best access for patients, the best cost, the best quality, all the rest of the things that free markets bring. But there is precedence for a very restricted oligopoly. We've seen that in some previous states, not a state as large as Florida. In states like Nevada and Illinois, which are the two states coming before Florida, we actually turned in applications in the state of Illinois yesterday. Illinois, for example, 60 dispensaries, statewide. Talking about five entities having the complete control of the program is extremely restricted, but there is precedence for it. The state of New York, as it stands right now, is pursuing something very similar that will work with five entities to control the entire state. So I think that those that are seeking those licenses are hopeful that if and when they do secure a license, that Amendment 2 won't change much. It'll just expand their capacity to provide medicine throughout the state. And I think that a lot of the business community is hoping, if and when Amendment 2 passes, that it will expand those that are able to go and seek licenses.
Is there any kind of corollary to this, as you call it, oligopoly? I mean, other industries back in the past, whether it's alcohol or other kinds of things which have had some kind of restriction, has it worked in the past, this kind of setup?
I think a state-driven oligopoly like that, sure. I mean, it works in, many different industries. Is it going to ultimately work in this industry? That remains to be seen. Massachusetts was the first state to implement any kind of program like that. They had 35 total licenses to grant across the state. They've only granted 11 of them as we have this conversation. So they're still figuring out how that whole program is going to work. And then, like I referenced, Nevada and Illinois after. So I think we will see restricted licensing in these states as they roll out medical marijuana programs moving forward. How restricted remains to be seen. What is that magic number? How close to a monopoly or oligopoly does this really end up being? But as it stands now, the way the states are pursuing this, it is restricted licensing, and the states feel like they have a better grasp of things when they can restrict who's doing business in the marijuana business, especially in their state. And I think they have a right to look at it that way.
There are some states, aren't there, are there not, or jurisdictions where sheriff's associations, police departments are actually on side with legalizing medical marijuana. California, if I'm not wrong, like, isn't there some, because that's where the kind of conflict between federal and state and local laws comes into play?
I can't speak to all of the different associations that are out there with law enforcement, but there are some associations in some counties and some states that are in favor of it for all the reasons that I just mentioned. It does actually help improve crime rates in the community. It does have a lot of positive effects. It does make their jobs more focused, and less focused on, the minor offense of having some type of small amount of marijuana and the amount of time and energy and resources that takes from departments. So, sure, there are people that are in favor of it, and then there are associations like those in Florida that aren't.
Recently in Orange County, the Zoning and Planning Commission had a discussion about where to place marijuana distribution or marijuana treatment centers in the county. And the commission has expressed a lot of concerns about everything from security, where they would be sited too close to schools, concerns about crime, other folks saying there would be undue restrictions if you put these in industrial zones, as they were suggesting. Then people who actually need it, they're going to have to go to these out of the way places, and they won't be able to get what will be medicine if it's made legal in November. Do you think Florida's ready for this?
No. I don't think any state's ready for this. This is brand new, right? This is brand new. It's never been done before in the state of Florida. And as we just mentioned, the demand is already there. So we're not building a brand new industry and it slowly growing it as we create demand and create awareness for our new product or new service. We're talking about a product that already has significant demand here in the state of Florida. And we're talking about taking it out of the black market and turning it into a legitimized business. So you're not talking about something that's going to happen slowly. So is the state of Florida ready? No, it's not. The state of Florida will need to ramp up, and I'm confident that the state of Florida will do so. Local jurisdictions having this conversation at this juncture, is it premature? Absolutely. Do I think it's a really good sign? Yes. The worst thing that a local jurisdiction can do is wait. We see that across the country, those local jurisdictions that wait and look for the state to lead them as to, the direction they need to be moving from a zoning standpoint, the state to lead them in the direction they need to move from a special use standpoint, and all the rest of the things that each local jurisdiction will go through. Those are the local jurisdictions that don't end up participating or end up participating in a way in which they're resentful or regretful at the end.
One of the other questions I heard during this commission debate was that, some of the commissioners thought, well, if it's passed in November, if it's made legal in November, it's essentially medicine. Why can't it just be dispensed through a pharmacy? Why isn't Walgreens here saying, yeah, we'll be dispensing it? I mean, is that something you see down the track, if not in Florida, elsewhere in the country?
I hope so. I hope that's where we all end up. That's why we're all doing this. But, until it's rescheduled, that conversation is just a naive conversation or an ignorant conversation. I mean, this is a Schedule I narcotic we're talking about. So on a federal level, there is no place for this as medicine. And obviously, anybody who wants to do any research on the studies that have been done, very credible, reputable studies out of states, countries like Israel that are doing real research on marijuana. I mean, there's tremendous medicinal efficacy to the plant. It's just that we're not there yet in the United States. So first we have to reclassify it. Then we have to, go through all the studies, and then you get, big pharma involved, and, this will become like, any other industry. We're just so nascent now, and you still have this gray market. The impact that this being a gray market has is that, you don't have big traditional business involved yet. But, will they get involved? I hope so. I don't know if you saw, but they all stopped, or I think they stopped selling cigarettes a couple weeks ago, which was tremendous. Hopefully in 5-10 years, and they replace cigarettes with marijuana products. I don't know. That'll be good for all of us that are involved in the industry.
Mm-hmm. What about funding for if you're trying to set up a business, a dispensary or a growing operation? I mean, if there are you know, laws prohibiting you from getting financing. How do you go about doing that?
Well, there's no laws prohibiting you from getting financing, first and foremost. That's a huge, it's a huge piece of misinformation. You know, the banking piece is something that I think is talked about, you know, and there's a lot of misinformation in this industry, but the banking piece is something that's particularly misrepresented. look, there are no big national banks that are dealing with marijuana, but that doesn't mean that it's illegal for them to do so. They're just choosing not to do so. In fact, the Treasury Department and the Department of Justice have issued memos giving very clear guidance as to how banks can bank this industry. And in states like Nevada and subsequently in Illinois and eventually here in Florida, you'll see that the banks will bank this industry. Will they give loans out for this industry? Not yet, but eventually. But you know, as I said, the feds have made it very clear cut. You want to deal with marijuana, here's how you deal with it. And there is a tremendous amount of money for banks that do want to do business in this industry. And banks have stepped up and are doing business in this industry. When will we see Wells Fargo and Bank of America doing so? I don't know the answer to that. But it probably, you know, trails your Walgreens question. You know, this needs to become more legitimate. We need to reclassify it, you know, eliminating both the federal perceived risk, but also the stigma.
What are you advising people who want to get into the distribution of the growing business, the medical marijuana business? What are you advising them about how to deal with that conflict between federal and local laws or state laws?
I think that this industry at this point, gray market industry, is for a very specific subset of the business community. I mean, this is for the most opportunistic entrepreneurial element of the business community in your state and in every state. if the gray market element bothers you, you shouldn't be in this business. Look, there are very few people that are going to end up eventually in this business in the state of Florida. And there are very many people right now that are interested in getting into this business, and I think they will weed themselves out. And yes, you do have this conflict. If you just look up the, you know, federal classification for marijuana, Schedule I narcotic, you're breaking federal law if you're involved in this business. And if that bothers you, you won't end up in this business. But those that are in this business, you know, they're okay with that risk. You know, they appreciate it in one way or another, but also, you know, can appreciate the upside and potential reward. And so those pioneers that choose to get involved now, we all hope we'll see, you know, a big payoff down the line, you know, for taking that risk and for being pioneers and everything that comes along with it.
How many states do you think it will take to legalize marijuana in some form before the federal government decides to have another look at the classification of marijuana?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if it's a number of states. I mean, if you look at polling, you know, you could ask the same question. What percentage of the American public would have to be polled? What percentage would have to be in favor before they would start seriously looking at it? If we're having that discussion, you know, that you know, that's already happened, right? And that's, you know, it's not just something recent. In the last couple of years, you've seen national opinion, you know, move towards the legalization of medical marijuana. So, you know, I don't really know the answer to that question. I think that as long as the Department of Justice keeps true to their word in respect to them respecting states' rights, I think that we will see a maturation of states' programs over the next, you know, 5+ years. And I don't really think that the federal reclassification will have anything to do with those, with that maturation process. I think that the states will continue to refine what they're doing, continue to do a better job of implementing these programs. And when federally they decide to change their outlook and the laws themselves, then I think, you know, we'll have that paradigm shift from gray market to full legitimization. And I think that you'll see institutional money flood the market. And I think that, you know, you're, again, getting back to your Walgreens comment at the beginning of the interview, that's when all of that takes place.
How many businesses do you think, or business people, are looking to come to Florida because of what's happening with Amendment 2?
Well, I think as what we've seen develop over the last couple of years is, you know, those really, really, you know, early states. You talk about California, Washington, and Colorado. You know, people, myself included, I mean, we grew up in those states. We've done business in the marijuana business in those states. And I think that folks like myself, you know, we're excited about the expansion of this industry across the country. And, you know, we do see a huge opportunity for us from a business standpoint to come in and help people that have never been in this industry before. So I think there are a lot of people that have had a lot of success in those states that I mentioned that are coming to Florida, just same way that we came, you know, we went to Illinois and the same way that we went to Nevada. You know, this is this is our reward for being pioneers for the last however many years we've been in this business, the same way that we're hopeful that those people that get into this business now in the state of Florida, they're rewarded 5-10 years from now for being pioneers in the state and, you know, as part of this movement.
I've been speaking to Adam Bierman. He's a medical marijuana industry consultant. Adam, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Up next, UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett takes a look at the gubernatorial debates and what's at stake for the candidates. Joining me by phone is Professor Aubrey Jewett. Aubrey is an associate professor in political science at the University of Central Florida. Aubrey, welcome back to the program.
Oh, it's great to be here, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
Well, the first of three debates was held last week in Miami, the first of three gubernatorial debates. It was hosted by Telemundo. Going into the debate, polls had Chris and Scott neck and neck. First of all, how important are these debates in helping voters make up their minds, Aubrey Jewett?
Well, you know, it depends. Some voters will ignore these debates completely, but others who are still undecided, and I think that that's probably still a fair percentage right now, the Florida electorate, can find some information if they take the time to look. And, of course, part of the format of the debates is not just about the policies that they discuss, because as we saw in the first issue, the first debate, there was a lot of personal attacks, not so much policy. But it does give you a look at how the candidates handle the pressure of debates, a little bit about their communication style, and decision-making when they're under pressure. So I think there are some good information that voters can get from these debates.
Would you expect less of the personal attacks in debate two coming up?
Well, I would like to think we will have less of the personal attacks and more focus on the issues, because traditionally that's what debates should be more about. Of course, we know that the campaign ads themselves have been really just mostly personal negative attacks. But traditionally, debates are about policy. You know, the moderators throw out questions almost always about policy and are trying to get the candidates to be real specific about what they would do or what they wouldn't do when they got in office. But the race has just been so negative and has had such a negative tone for months and months now that although I hope they'll talk more about policy, I fear that we'll still get a heavy dose of the personal nasty attacks.
The first debate, of course, broadcast in Spanish. What does that show us about the importance of the Hispanic electorate in this election?
Well, the Hispanic vote is becoming increasingly important, not only across the country, but right here in Florida, with about 14% of all registered voters Hispanic. And really, the population in the state is about 21 or something percent Hispanic. And so the percent of registered voters is just going to go up over time. And on the Hispanic vote is also somewhat split. If you look at all registered Hispanics, they do tend to be more Democratic than Republican. But Florida's always been a little bit out of the mainstream when it comes to the Hispanic vote compared to the rest of the country, because we've got the Cuban vote, which has traditionally been quite Republican. And you do have a high number of Hispanics that are in play, swing voters, independents as well. So I think the fact that they did the first debate and that it was translated into Spanish, and that actually Governor Scott did part of his own closing statement in Spanish, just goes to show that both candidates realize, particularly in a very close race that might be decided by just one or two percentage points, you can't ignore 14% of the electorate. Not only can't you ignore them, you really got to go after them and try to make them understand that you understand what they would like out of government and that you're going to try to do it.
The issue of Cuba came up in the debate. Of course, Rick Scott saying the embargo should stay. Charlie Crist saying, although he supported the embargo in the past, he thinks it's time to put that to rest. Obviously, there's some political calculations going on there. Just how important is that traditional Cuban Republican vote? But what are your thoughts on Crist's kind of change of heart there?
Well, it is interesting, you know, with Charlie Crist, he's had a lot of changes of heart, apparently, in the last few years on a lot of different policies. And, you know, this is one of them where he originally took the sort of the standard Republican line, which is be tough on Cuba. That's how Republicans were able to get the majority of the Cuban vote for so many years, is they were considered the party that was going to be much tougher on communism, going all the way back to Reagan and even before that, and particularly tough on Castro. And now we, of course, see that Charlie Crist is saying that perhaps we should end the embargo. As he said, basically we've been trying to do the same thing for about five decades, and it just doesn't seem to be working, and so therefore to continue to do it, you know, just doesn't make sense. And maybe it just punishes the average Cuban people, and it would be better to open up and have trade and access, and maybe that would actually create change in Cuba faster than trying to isolate them. And, of course, Governor Scott is pretty much taking the traditional continued Republican line of, you know, keeping tough. Whether or not this actually impacts too much the existing Cuban vote, you know, remains to be seen. As I said, it probably most likely you're going to see middle-aged and older Cubans will support Scott fairly strongly, and you'll probably see younger Cubans supporting Charlie Crist. But I think they probably would do that regardless of whether they talk too much about Cuba or not. And in fact, of course, it's interesting because as governors of Florida, they really have almost nothing to do with the federal policy that sets the embargo on Cuba. You know, our U.S. senators and our congressional representatives, you know, clearly they might have something to say about it. But as governors, they actually do not. It's more of a symbolic stance to try to score points where they don't actually have any power to do anything about it.
We talked before about the negative TV ad campaign and the shots that each of these two candidates were taking at each other throughout that first debate. But I'm wondering if you think, Aubrey Jewitt, whether voters are going to be turned off. Are they getting tired of all this negative politicking? And, you know, it might be a good idea for the two candidates to focus more on policy for the last few weeks of this campaign.
Well, you know, strategically, you certainly could argue that at some point, both candidates hopefully will come to the realization that presenting a more positive image, talking a little more about what they're going to do for the state and trying to be a little more positive about themselves could actually help them at this point. You know, voters are really inundated and have been inundated, just swamped with negative attacks and particularly personal attacks. There's been some about policy attacks, which is a slightly different thing, but mostly it's just been personal attacks. And, of course, both sides have been doing it because they fear that if they don't, their opponent will get an advantage. You know, for instance, Governor Scott, because he had a ton of money and the Republican Party had a ton of money, really started running ads very early against Charlie Crist, very personal and negative, going all the way back to March. And it worked. At the time, the early polls had Charlie Crist up by 5-10 points. And, of course, because of those negative attacks, Scott was able to drive down Charlie Crist approval ratings, and of course now they're neck and neck. And in return, of course, the Democratic Party and Charlie Crist have been attacking Rick Scott because they know the same thing. Hey, if we don't attack, you know, counterattack from their perspective, then we're going to lose out. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where the average voter, of course, does not really like the negative ads, particularly when they see them over and over again. But political research shows and campaign research shows that negative ads are effective, and that's why they're used. But at a certain point, and I think you made a good point, at a certain point, and maybe about now, with less than a month to go before the actual elections, we may see a turn more towards the positive. We could always hope that we'll see maybe a turn towards the positive.
What about the
candidates lay out their positive view for Florida a little more effectively and spend a little less time just hammering each other personally?
Mm-hmm. What about the impact in terms of getting out the vote? I mean, if there's a negative impact from these negative ads, if that's going to keep people away from the polls, is there a counter impact from, say, Amendment 2? Because that was talked about a lot, you know, the early part of this year, that might get younger voters out to the polls, the Vote Yes on 2 movement. Of course, there's a pretty powerful counter lobby to that as well. But what are your thoughts on that? Is that going to have some kind of impact on driving voter turnout?
Well, it certainly might. I suspect we are going to have lower turnout, you know, in terms of a governor's race, what we might expect than normal. And probably a lot of that could be laid at the the doorstep of the really, truly negative tone of this campaign. Because, again, it just turns a lot of voters out off, and particularly swing voters, independent voters, people that are not registered with one of the major parties. I mean, those people are pretty disgusted by the tone of the campaign as well, but usually they're more likely to turn out because they have a strong allegiance to one party or the other. And whether or not we actually see a sort of a counteracting effect because of this medical marijuana amendment, I think it's possible that particularly among younger voters. I mean, that's been the sort of the straightforward analysis most people have brought to this, is that, and some people actually on the Republican side have accused John Morgan and the Democrats of doing this intentionally, you know, sort of pushing this medical marijuana issue to try to increase turnout among younger voters who then,
right,
while they were there, might also just go ahead and mark off the ballot for Charlie Crist, you know, the Democratic candidate.
I think John Morgan's been pretty upfront about that. I mean, he's basically sort of used his platform in some of these debates about medical marijuana afterwards to say, yes, go vote, young folks, but not in those kind of words, of course.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I actually had also read something else. So when he was doing a speaking event the other day, somebody asked him, well, what's more important to you, the medical marijuana or Charlie Crist? And he said, well, when push comes to shove, I spent over $5 million on the medical marijuana amendment, and I like Charlie Crist a lot, but I haven't spent $5 million on it. So.
Right. Just finally, Aubrey, Adrian Wiley, in Friday's debate, some of his supporters were out in front of where it was being taped. They had placards. They were accusing both Charlie Crist and Governor Scott of being, in inverted commas, the chicken brothers. But what are your thoughts on this? I mean, does Wiley have any shot of getting into the next debate? And what is the impact of him in terms of, you know, swinging the vote one way or another from these two main candidates?
It depends on the debate organizers, of course, whether or not he gets in and what threshold they establish for getting into to debates. You know, usually it's been, hey, you got to draw at least 10 or 15% in polls in order to show that you're a viable candidate. And quite frankly, some polls have shown him just about there. So, you know, potentially, maybe he might be able to convince the people running the debate. Of course, the candidates sometimes have a veto power over that as well, and it's probably in both of their best interests not to have him on the stage, mm-hmm, because he is drawing in some polls as much as 10%. And whether or not that could impact the race, I mean, it certainly could. When you show when the polls show that the main two candidates, Crist and Scott, regularly are within 1 to 2 percentage points of each other, then if you talk about a third party person that's drawing up to 10%, then certainly that could affect the outcome of this race. And it just depends which polls that you look at. There's been a couple polls that have suggested that Adrian Wiley, the Libertarian, is drawing fairly equally from both parties. That basically, if you ask the question of people that support Wiley, if he wasn't on the ballot, you know, who would you vote for? You get about half say they wouldn't vote at all, and then the other half sort of split between the Republicans and Democrats. On the other hand, there's been a couple that have shown that he draws disproportionately from Republicans, and that is traditionally what you see. Libertarians, there's sort of a libertarian wing or strain of the Republican Party, and so potentially it, you know, might draw 1 or 2 percentage points from Rick Scott, which in a close race, you know, could be the difference.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Professor Aubrey Jewett. He's Associate Professor in Political Science at the University of Central Florida. Aubrey, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, thank you, Matt.
Second of three gubernatorial debates is Wednesday. 90.7 is teaming up with public radio stations across the state to cover the event. Tune in tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. for a live broadcast of the debate. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.